The Guardian.
I'm Heather Stewart. This is Politics Weekly. Leaked drafts of Labour's manifesto reveal the party's most radical policy platform in a generation. Buses, rail and mail all renationalised, tuition fees scrapped and taxes on business and the well-off hiked up to pay for it all. Do the sums add up? And does that really matter anyway in an election that seems to have forgotten about the deficit? Also this week, with 4 weeks until polling day, we've had soundbites, gaffes, garbled policy and a blizzard of announcements. Is any of it cutting through to voters? And with parties spending huge sums on social media, has election law kept pace with the technology? Plus, all aboard the Lib Dem battle bus. We'll hear from leader Tim Farron, who's on a mission to win back the South West. But first, when Jeremy Corbyn took control of the Labour Party almost 2 years ago, it was with pledges to completely remake Britain's economy from the bottom up. He claimed that decades of right-wing or centre-left governments had failed to do enough for the average voter and he would bring sweeping changes. Well, now we've had a glimpse of what he means. And as well as scrapping tuition fees, nationalisations and taxes on the rich, there are plans to widen the scope of freedom of information laws and a pledge to oppose a second Scottish referendum. Well, I'm joined now by Guardian columnist Raphael Baer, our technology reporter Alex Hearn and Polly Billington, a former advisor to Ed Miliband who stood as a candidate for Labour herself. Polly, there's quite a lot to digest here, isn't there? And different versions floating around. But there are plenty of retail offers Labour can make on the doorstep, aren't there? There was a little while ago, there were Labour people saying, I don't know what we stand for, I don't know what our policies are. Certainly can't say that now.
That's true. I think the thing is, having a retail offer is fine. There has to be a credibility about being able to deliver it. And it needs to clearly connect with what people think that they need and that it should be seen to be fair, that the effort that is going to have to be made either nationally or personally in order to be able to achieve it is a reasonable one. So, for example, some people will say free school meals for everybody means that there's, you know, in economic speak, it's sort of like loads of dead weight, money being spent on people who don't need it. If you make it in terms of everybody getting decent, healthy, nourishing food, and that improves the quality of the lives and of children and their chances, you can tell a different story. What I'm really saying is that you can have lots and lots of retail offer. And in fact, this is much bigger and arguably bolder than what was on offer 2 years ago. But the narrative makes the difference. And what is the story that it's telling about the kind of country we want to be? There is lots of opportunities there. But my argument is a manifesto is only one element, is only one thing that you've got to play with. And on its own, it won't be that narrative. And if it is just a list of things that you wish could happen, people on the doorstep will say, well, I might want that to happen, but I don't believe that you can necessarily deliver it. That's a challenge that the Labour Party has now got in the next few weeks.
And they also have to appeal, don't they, to a wide group of voters. So I was at the campaign battle bus launch earlier in the week, and there was a lot of talk about kind of terrible injustices and, you know, poverty and people using food banks and kids, you know, not eating enough at school and really, you know, kind of tugging at the heartstrings, really moral, important stuff. You also need a message, don't you, for what we used to call the aspirational voter, well, or the, I don't, yes, know, the, I mean, white van man or whatever we that, call them now.
Dare I say, that's a very sort of New Labour way of thinking of it. What my, you know, one of my good...
Slap on the wrist for me.
Good comrades in 2015, Rowena Davis, said what the problem was with our offer in 2015 is that we only cared about people as though they were needy or greedy. And actually, there's a whole lot of people in between who are actually working people who need to be able to make sure they get something out of it. Sometimes that is literally transactional. What am I going to get from you? Is that a tax cut or a tax freeze or something that is definitely going to improve the quality of my life, i.e. an energy cap or whatever, and whether you can deliver that. But there has to also be a values offer. And if you think about the coalition you need to build, it needs to include the people that Jeremy Corbyn and the current Labour Party are much more popular with, in the sort of pioneers, your metropolitan, liberal, young voters, less popular with your prospectors who say that what they're interested in is how are you going to do things better for me, but actually have a values base too. And your settlers, your older, more anxious voters, if you can't pull together a coalition of those four, those three groups of people, then you're going to be in trouble. And at the moment, if you, I'm, you know, I can be terribly worried about people who are worse off than me, but that's, dare I say, also pretty bloody Fabian, right? And I'm doing things to people. I want to do things on behalf of me and people in my interest. And if you don't see yourself as part of a wider coalition, you're doing things for somebody else, well, you know, frankly, that's pretty high Tory, actually.
And sort of patrician rather
it's
than
patrician,
kind of...
Yeah.
Raph, is this a kind of message, a narrative that Labour can unite around, do you think, these policies? It's obviously quite radical stuff.
It certainly is that. I think at this stage, when you've got polling day, you know, within a month, the expectation is just that the Labour Party will have to cobble together some semblance of unity and just fight on and try and grind out what they can seat by seat. So those Labour MPs or people in the Labour Party who think some of this is going to drive voters away or they don't agree with it, either on practical or principled grounds, don't really have much they can do about that now. They're in an election situation. But I thought what you said, Heather, was very interesting in terms of, you know, who obviously this appeals to a certain kind of Labour supporter, maybe not so much to, for example, people who voted Conservative in a last general election and might be thinking about voting Conservative again. Now, there is one conception of your task as a political party in a general election, which is to persuade people who might vote for the other side to vote for you instead. That might be a terribly new Labour conception, but it's also a way to win power. And you get a very strong feeling with this manifesto that really isn't actually the sort of the leadership, the Jeremy Corbyn agenda. He's done his greatest moments in politics in the last 2 years have been the two leadership contests. That was when he was in his element. He actually looked like he was enjoying himself. And it was very, very successful for him within the party, within the left. Those were his finest hours. And it just appears to me that they are replaying that. That could be very deliberate, that they know they're going to lose the general election and they're positioning themselves in terms of running another leadership contest just to absolutely consolidate Jeremy's position in the left. Or it might be that that is literally the only way they know how to campaign. And so they're just sort of, that's what they've taken down off the shelf. And they're running that sort of pret-a-porter Jeremy Corbyn leadership campaign. But this is what it looks like to me.
And Alex, when I went along to the event earlier in the week, there were a lot of young people there, including students who had, you know, done their first exam and it was their reward to kind of go and see Jeremy doing his stump speech. And there's quite a lot of policy aimed at young people who the polls tell us are more enthusiastic about Labour than other parties and who maybe, you know, don't care about whether we're going back to the 70s or not because they weren't born and it means nothing to them. Will young people go out and vote on the back of this, do you think?
Well, I mean, that's the big question, isn't it? It's young people can often show huge enthusiasm when asked questions, but
you're the token young person, mate. It's all relative.
don't turn up to the polls in any large numbers. And I've not yet seen anything to suggest that there is some sort of Corbyn effect which might take place in turnout. The fact that Corbyn has a lot of young supporters does not also mean that a lot of young people like Jeremy Corbyn. You know, we've got two different questions here. I do think that one thing, which is very true, is I have no memory of the 70s. I have no memory of the 80s. I've very little memory of the 1990s. I am not...
Whippersnapper.
Is that because you're off your face and then sort of rave drugs or what? You're actually so young that you don't actually remember the 1990s.
Is this a family podcast?
talking about the bad old days doesn't really mean a huge amount to what is probably a core part of Jeremy Corbyn's fan base. These people under 30 who... basically, their memory of politics is that it was good at the beginning of the noughties and it is bad now after 7 years of Tory government. One of the policies which I found particularly interesting, just plucking something out of this, which has been called a return to the 1970s, is Corbyn's stance on maintenance grants, on paying people a grant if they're going to university, which has been held up as one of those back to the 70s policies, back to the days when you were paid to go to university as a student. But of course, actually, maintenance grants were removed 2 or 3 years
ago. Quite recently.
It was a means-tested benefit, which was given to students whose parents had incomes under a certain threshold. I know a lot of people who are at university at the same time as me who received them. So this policy, which is very easily spun as a back to the 70s thing, could be, you know, there's a lack of detail, devil is in the implementation, but it could just be back to 2014.
But can I say, Alex, the maintenance grants is exactly the kind of thing that I got on the doorstep in Thurrock of people who were saying, you know, you can spend your time talking about fees, but I can't send my kid can't go because they can't afford to live, right? So actually, it's an entirely practical offer. And in fact, there was a partial amount of it in the 2015 manifesto. A, it's expensive, but B, you need to start telling the story a long time before now. And I think that's one of the things that's quite tragic. It will get framed as a back to the 70s, wish list. There's a lot in here which actually are the beginnings of ways of meeting the challenges of the 21st century. They're not properly developed, probably, at this, bearing in mind we're going to the polls in 3 weeks, but this is a snap election. And either you pull stuff off the shelf and Raf's got a point there, actually, about whether this is just pulling it off the shelf because that's the only way they know how to campaign. I don't think that's entirely true or fair, because a lot of this is actually stuff that's been around in the Labour Party for a long time but hasn't gone through, necessarily, from what I can see, the iterations of who does this speak to, how do we tell the story, how do we fund it, and the how do we fund it isn't necessarily a dots and comma thing in terms of the sums, but just a broad understanding of whether this is worthwhile in terms of national effort, money spent, who's going to pay for it and so forth, which tells a story about what your priorities are. I think this feels like a lot of priorities.
I think, putting on my Corbynista hat for a moment, which doesn't
really... I didn't know you had one, Ralph.
No, it doesn't fit very, very well, to be honest. But no, I think the position, an argument would be, well, look, it's going through the iterations and consulting and trying to keep everyone happy that produces a kind of policy mulch that is sort of pleasing neither one side nor the other and sort of waters everything down. So, for example, in the 2015 manifesto, the Labour offer on tuition fees was neither to scrap them nor keep them, but to just sort of reduce them by about a third and pay for it with a sort of tweak around pension contributions, as I remember rightly. And it doesn't sort of cut through. I thought that the leadership's argument now would be, at least send up some kind of firework that just lights up the sky so people have to be talking about
true,
your policy.
I think that's true, but only have two or three of them. That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah, they've basically set fire to the whole box of fireworks for this, haven't they?
If you just had two or three and you said, we're not going to worry about fees, we're just going to do maintenance grants, we're going to prioritise early years, we're going to do something about the energy companies. Those three things. But if you ask for everything, it's a credibility issue. In 2015, we were offering a decent minimum wage, cracking down on 0 hours contracts, the end of exploitation, lots of things that really mattered for people in Thurrock. And they looked at me and said, listen, you can't clear up the dog mess and you're not dealing with immigration. So why should I believe you on all of this stuff that you say you're going to be able to do? I don't believe you're able to do this. Now, that isn't just about your economic credibility. It's about where the Labour Party had, in a sense, over a period of years, absented itself from active involvement in the economy and particularly the employment end of the economy. And then if we say this now, we are actually talking about things that people care about, but they're not necessarily my anxiety is we won't be seen as the people who will be able to deliver it.
And what about the idea that so another thing you would hear the leadership say, I think, and people around them, is that the kind of the centre has moved or the narrative has changed or there are, you've got a apparently right of centre government, which has absolutely wholesale adopted an Ed Miliband policy capping energy prices, which
they haven't actually, because all they've done is talked about the energy cap and they haven't talked about reforming the market.
The Labour manifesto, as we understand it, has an idea about sort of locally owned generators, which might be cooperatives or might be owned by local government, but which would try and compete in some way. I mean, I don't know how plausible you think that is, but it is something to try and crack the market problem, isn't it?
Andrew Gwynne said this morning, these kind of things are not being plucked out of the sort of unicorns and sparkles.
No, there's a long
these things
history
happen
that,
in Europe. It's not as though we're suddenly sort of either masquerading as Venezuela, which is one of the accusations that is made, or plucking them out of the unicorn box. These are things that actually happen in other parts of the developed industrialised world, and we shouldn't see them as some kind of weird 1970s bogeyman.
Raf, what do you think? Does it kind of open up a space to talk about some of these things? Because you've got a Tory government that, Theresa May talks about kind of intervention and...
Well, first of all, the criticism, or if it is even a criticism, that somehow Theresa May, it's terribly embarrassing that she's now doing something along the lines of something Ed Miliband, once said he would do, and isn't that awfully hypocritical and why shouldn't people attack her? But yeah, that's essentially a kind of a pointless argument. I mean, the fact is Theresa May, as sort of Polly kind of implied earlier, comes from a platform of having built up a lot of de facto credibility simply by the fact of being Prime Minister and the Tories having been in government. So it's a completely different context in which that's being presented. Now, in terms of whether or not having a very radical left manifesto for Labour opens up certain possibilities. I think to an extent it probably does. I mean, there will be a lot of sound and fury and noise, but if people are, you know, it's not unreasonable now, actually, after a whole generation, to actually have a serious conversation about nationalisation and, you know, whether or not privatisation did everything that it was promised to do. That's a perfectly sensible conversation to have. I think there is an opposite danger, however, which is, and this is where I have to take my Corbynista hat very much off now, which is that because the Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell proposition is so lacking in credibility for so many people, and there are so many people in the country who just simply look at them and think there's absolutely no way I would put you in charge of running this country, that they contaminate the idea. So, you know, as we've heard from Paul and Alex, you know, it might not make sense to say these things are just a throwback to the 1970s. It does actually make more sense to say specifically Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell are throwbacks to the 1970s and 1980s. That is a more plausible and credible attack on them. And as a result, their image actually then makes it harder to have a serious discussion about these policies on the terms that Polly was talking about. And that, I think, will be frustrating for a lot of people in Labour. You'd like this space to open up, but it still just does come down to this problem of the leadership not actually having done the work to create a political project where that kind of conversation can happen.
Alex, you're nodding there.
Yeah, just the most interesting example I saw of that was today on the Today Show when John Humphreys was attacking the idea of extending HS2 to Scotland, which is in the Labour manifesto and which has been in the HS2 plan pretty much from the start. It is part of the end goal of HS2. But once it makes it in this manifesto from this Labour Party, it becomes an insane throwback idea. A railway, high-speed railway to Scotland. Wild. Justify that. How are you going to spend it? And this is a broadly cross-party consensus that one day, HS2, there will be a high-speed line running up to Edinburgh and Glasgow. That's been there for a long time, but suddenly it needs to be defended by the Labour Party.
Well, with the caveat that these measures are still provisional, the pressure will now be on the Shadow Treasury team to show their sums add up. Joining me on the line now is Paul Johnson of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which comes into its own election time, running the slide rule over the party's tax and spending policies. Paul, with a month to go, how much do we know about the parties and how much they will tax and spend?
Well, we clearly know from today's leaked Labour manifesto that they're looking at spending a very, very large amount more than the Conservatives will. We're looking at an additional $25 billion a year on infrastructure spending, an additional $10 billion a year or so to cover the impact of getting rid of university tuition fees. We've already heard that they're looking at $7 or $8 billion on other aspects of education. There's the multiple billions that will be required to renationalise the energy companies and so on. And then I'm afraid I haven't got through the rest of the manifesto, but there's obviously an awful lot of other promises in there. How much that adds up to, I don't know. On the tax side, Labour have suggested a historically very big increase in corporation tax, increasing it by about 40%, about one full percentage point of national income, which we were quite amused to see they describe in their manifesto as asking corporations to pay a little more. And they've said that they'll increase tax on those earning over 80,000 a year, but we have no details of that yet. So that is, in terms of taxes and spending, a dramatically different picture to, whilst we don't know exactly what the Conservatives will say, but certainly going to be a dramatically different picture to what they suggest.
So it is right to say then, as Labour does, that this would be quite a sort of transformative approach, but would it presumably the larger a tax increase you do, the more you have to worry about whether you'll really get the revenue you hope for? You know, how concerned would you be about a sort of shift in fiscal policy on this scale?
Well, it's certainly transformative what the Labour Party is suggesting here. And I think it's important to be clear that this is not just about tax and spending. This is about the state getting deeply involved in much more of the private sector than it has been certainly since the 1970s and possibly since the 1940s with respect to saying, you know, telling banks which bank branches they can and can't close, setting minimum wages for a quarter of private sector workers and about 60% of young people, and dramatically including labour regulation. So all of those things are utterly different to anything we've experienced in many, many decades.
So the Daily Telegraph headline this morning about taking us back to the 70s is perhaps not outrageous.
If you take what's here at face value, then much of it, I think, is unprecedented even in the 1970s. I mean, this is a level of state intervention that, as I say, probably goes back more decades than that. But coming to your earlier question about what then do we know about the tax implications of some of these things? Well, if you do raise corporate tax as high as is being suggested here, then you probably will get 18, 19, 20 billion a year in the short run. But for sure, it will result in less investment and in the UK. And in the long run, the amount that you get from that would be significantly less than the immediate tax take.
And those high earners over £80,000, that is only the top 5% of earners, isn't it? Could they pay a bit more? Will they try and avoid it, do you think?
Well, the top, you're right, £80,000 is the top 5% or so of earners. You could probably get a small number of billions from that group in by increasing tax. Shall we say 5 billion? I'm plucking that number slightly from the air, but I don't think you could get significantly more than that. And we do know that the best estimate of the amount that you can get from people earning over 150,000 because of the capacity they have to avoid tax and so on is probably zero. So most of that,
because we've tried
revenue,
it, right?
Exactly. Most of that additional revenue would come from the rich-ish, but not the super rich.
That was Paul Johnson, director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Raf, when you have nearly a decade of deficit targets missed and the EU waving around bills for 100 billion quid, is it credible for the Tories to paint Labour as irresponsible?
The short answer is no, by any rational, dispassionate analysis.
But
for reasons, see conversations pass him, they do seem to be able to get away with it for all sorts of reasons, partly because the Labour Party just aren't effective as an opposition. Look, it is one of the most extraordinary features of this campaign and British politics at the moment that the single greatest issue that absolutely dominated politics for the whole of the last Parliament, which is the deficit and the debt and how you manage those issues, has just been sort of blasted out of the water by Brexit and by the fact that we now have a different Prime Minister and a different Chancellor who are framing things differently. That says two things. One, it shows you quite how much power a government has to set the terms of debate on their choosing. I mean, the one of the reasons the deficit, all the arguments we had about the deficit were organised the way they were in terms of what constitutes economic credibility and the question being how much you cut and how quickly rather than whether you should and these sorts of arguments was because George Osborne was quite an effective political strategist and had a very good grasp of how to set, how to sort of control political communications and dictate the terms to the opposition, and he made that the subject, and so everyone talked about it. Some people try to resist that narrative, but he was really very, very effective at that for a long time. Now we're talking about Brexit, but it is still the underlying point to make here is it is still a technical fact that the UK has a very large fiscal deficit and has not successfully managed to bring the debt down in anything like the ways that the Tory government said they would, and we simply don't know how much leeway in the global marketplace you have to continue along those lines, especially if part of the Brexit process starts to undermine your credibility in other areas. So you certainly speak to Treasury ministers, speak to Treasury civil servants, they will say, yes, George Osborne over-politicised the necessity of getting this stuff under control, and actually that was a bit of a game. But yes, also, it really does matter that you keep a very clear, firm eye on your fiscal credibility when you're going into a turbulent period, which Brexit will be.
Polly, poor old Ed Miliband got a very hard time for forgetting about the deficit or forgetting to mention the deficit in one of his key speeches, didn't he, in the run-up to the 2015 election. It's a strange kind of campaign now, isn't it, that we're barely talking about it?
Well, we're barely talking about it because Brexit has become the deficit as the sort of big thing within which everything is framed. It is as unwieldy, arguably, as the deficit in that it is unknowable. And actually, it's worse than the deficit because at least with the deficit, you've got two kind of ways of dealing with it in politics. You've got the centre-right George Osborne way, which is to frame it as a massive problem problem and use it to significantly reduce the size of the state. You've got the way that arguably the Labour Party should have been doing, but didn't do in a strong enough way because they didn't have the courage of their convictions, to say, in fact, the only way you get out of this is to invest in the infrastructure.
Grow your way out of it.
Grow your way out of it with infrastructure things. We are going to end up, I mean, if the Tory party has now understood this, and that's why we have a department with industrial strategy in its title, and yet has still got some ideological kind of conflictions about whether they actually want to be able to deliver that properly. Now, Brexit then says all of those things are now in a framework within which we do not know what our trade relations will be, what our environmental or consumer standards will be. We don't know who we will be able to sell to or buy to. We don't know what the impacts are on our supply chain. And we do know, and everyone will have heard the focus groups either on the television or the radio, or they'll have read them, where people are saying, we just want out. Why doesn't it all just go away? Because it feels to most people that it's a simple thing. We said no, we want to go.
Let's get
and
on
the
with
reality
it.
Of the reality is far more complex, and politics in this country is not up to bridging that gap between the simplicity of what people asked for and the complexity of making that a reality, especially in the context of what kind of country you want to be. Because in a way, we've almost got sort of ideology. I know this is going to sound weird in the era of Corbyn, but arguably we've got quite a lot of ideology-free politicians. So they don't really know what they want it to be like, especially in the context of other wider global trends like automation and so forth. And so that you retreat back to your retail offer because at least it's something that you can say.
Well, your leadership style, your strong and stable leadership, you know, there's absolutely no content, ideological or otherwise,
it allows,
does it? It's
allows,
a style.
It allows your voters just to project onto you whatever they want.
Well, we'll have plenty more on the manifestos when they're published next week on theguardian.com/politics. Now, if the Lib Dems are to return in significant numbers to Parliament next month, they will need to win back a lot of voters in southwest England, and it's going to be a tough job. Most of the constituencies voted to leave the EU, and the party's local election results were disappointing. But our reporter Jess Elgott has hit the road this week on the party's battle bus.
We're actually speeding through the Cornish countryside. It's a massive yellow bus, as you'd expect. It's actually pretty luxurious inside. There's Wi-Fi for the many journalists that are sitting on board the bus. There's leather seats. There's tables for everyone to work from. So this is the first proper week of Tim Farron, the Lib Dem leader's tour around the country on his battle bus. And battle buses have had a bit of a bad reputation over the past few months. The Conservative Party got in trouble with the Electoral Commission for using them to ship in activists to target seats in the 2015 election. But the Lib Dems, at least the one I'm on, has got a much more traditional use, which shouldn't fall foul of any difficulties. It's a bus for journalists, for their camera crews, for advisers and press officers to take the leader around the country. So we're going to go in and meet some of the people on the battle bus.
Introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Paul Butters, and I'm the principal spokesperson for the leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Yes, you are.
What's your job on the bus, Paul?
My job is to give you the bus gold every day. So it's the story of the day that's been gridded and other stories that we're doing. And also to deal with any press inquiries that you all have, any rebuttal to other parties, and anything else that comes up in the day, which is goes from the sublime to the ridiculous.
How many phone calls would you say you get a day on this bus?
20 or 30 minimum, probably. From FOI people in like Wiltshire County Council to Good Morning Wales to...
He's always skulking around looking a little bit suspicious.
Thank you, Christine. A lot of requests, and they're all very valuable.
They are very valuable.
Thanks, boss.
You deal with them very professionally.
Thanks, Tim. To be frank, being the Lib Dems, you have to take every opportunity you can to get in the 6 and the 10 and get people to cover you. So we do things like getting Tim on a hovercraft.
Yes.
Because it works.
It does.
Hello, I'm Christine Norworth. I'm Broadcast and Visits Officer.
Tell us, what's your day-to-day job on the bus?
On the bus, right, so I wake up at silly o'clock. I make sure that, well, so this morning I had to make sure that everyone had all their boarding passes for our flight from Edinburgh to Bristol. I had a slight panic that Paul didn't have one, but it was all fine in the end. And then, yeah, it's basically just corralling people. I'm constantly doing head counts, trying to make sure that I haven't left behind a journalist. And I haven't done so far, so you're welcome, Jess.
How many hours of logistics would you say go into planning a kind of tour like this?
Well, so with a tour, we have advanced teams and things like that, so they'll go ahead and do the bulk of the kind of visualising how it's all going to pan out, and then I'm just doing the more reactive logistics, like making sure that the driver actually knows where he's going, which is good. He has had the correct postcode so far, so I think I'm due for a pay rise.
Duly noted.
Yeah.
Why do party leaders decide to do this sort of thing, come on a battle bus, tour around the country in a big yellow bus?
Well, somebody came up with the idea long before me. I think the reason it's a good idea is because obviously it's visible. It gives an opportunity to go to lots of different places and to add some value. I know that a leader's visit can sometimes be a pain in the backside, having received them from great leaders in the past. They take a lot of organisation. They stop, you know, 30, 40 people knocking on doors for a period of time. So you make sure you do something which gives a good, you know, visual hit for them, encourages activists to work that a bit harder, so it's an investment for them. But it's also, as you can see, an opportunity for folks like you to spend time with us, not spend time with you, and you can talk to us formally and informally, and it gives us the opportunity to be in the story.
You're doing a tour of the Southwest at the moment. That's an area that's, you know, used to be Lib Dem heartlands, but now, you know, after the Brexit vote, it's got a strong Leave vote down there, and also it's almost entirely Tory down here now. So what's the aim for this particular part of the tour?
Well, I think, I mean, wherever you go, there is an increasing realisation that the general election is a done deal. In one sense, that is something which, you know, we might feel very sad about, but I also just think, let's not pretend something's the case that isn't. And Theresa May's trying to make out that she's fighting against some kind of non-existent group of who make up an alternative government. She's going to be the next Prime Minister, and the question is, will she be able to take us for granted? Or, when I say us, I mean our communities, you, your family, and here in the West Country in particular. Or will you have a strong opposition that actually speaks up for local communities and tempers that landslide? If she has the kind of majority that, you know, Theresa May had, sorry, Margaret Thatcher had in the 80s, she would just take places like the West Country for granted. And I think that's beginning to be obvious to people. So I think Brexit is an issue, and I think the recent revelations of the May-Juncker spat, they're just a little window on the future, which is, you know, the next year or so, with lots of he said, she said, and politicians in vape-filled rooms sort of stitching up your future and your children's future. And that seems to me to be wrong. That's not very democratic. And the people should have the final say. So our major short window policy on Brexit, that the people should have the final say on the deal, I think is increasingly attractive to people who voted Leave, actually, who are increasingly aware that there's something, you know, a bit fishy about the whole process of stitching up a deal that'll affect them and they'll have no say over.
But you've been going around the place, sort of meeting voters out on the streets. You had quite a memorable encounter with Malcolm
Baker. Lovely Malcolm, yeah.
Why do you... The PM would say, you know, she's out there beating regular voters, but sort of clearly doesn't want to necessarily take that risk. Why do you think the risk of that kind of confrontation is worthwhile while you're on the campaign?
It's not a risk, is it? I mean, you might be made to look a mug by somebody. That's always possible. Somebody might come up and say something to you on camera that is the opposite of the position you're trying to push for that day. It might be embarrassing, but it's far better than hiding yourself away from people. You say you want to lead the people and you look like you don't like them because you won't talk to them. That's far from far worse. And frankly, you know, you're better at what you do if you're prepared to go out there and be put on the spot by somebody who asks you something utterly random and potentially hostile. That's great. That's what democracy is all about.
Jessica Rail got there reporting. Now, election communications have been subject to the law of the land since the late 19th century. They were updated for the television age, and broadcasters faced strict laws around balance and accuracy. But with most of the population now getting at least some of their news online, the law has not kept pace. Facebook, Google, Twitter and others are far less regulated for political content than the BBC and ITV. Podcasts like this one are in a regulation grey zone. So is Britain's election law fit for the new media age? I asked Damian Tambini, a political scientist and specialist in this area at the London School of Economics.
No, they are not fit for a social media age. There are a number of ways in which campaigning is changing really quite rapidly. Now, we saw in the 2015 election, saw it also in the referendum, campaign managers are actually shifting most of their spend to new kinds of tools just simply because they're more effective. And this is almost all social media campaigning, in particular Facebook. And the reason that that is more efficient and you get more bang for your buck is because, particularly in national elections, targeting spending on particular kinds of voters is simply more effective.
But does it actually work? There's very little data available.
Evidence that it works, I think, is the fact that it's used. Very difficult to measure and isolate in any kind of advertising campaign an outcome and say that is due to the use of a particular campaign tool. But if you speak to campaigners, and we've spoken to a number for some research we're doing here, they are of the view that they work better, and that's why they're moving a lot of their spend online. I think it's as simple as that. We are conducting some research. You may have heard of the project Who Targets Me? And that's a project which is asking consumers or asking voters to download a plugin for their Chrome browser. And what that enables is the scraping of data. Basically, the program will monitor the political ads that you are receiving, and it will automatically analyze those and categorize those. And we're working with Who Targets Me to try and reverse engineer what kind of targeted messages are being deployed so that we can get at the reality of what's going on, because there's a huge amount of hype out there about terrible, spooky things happening, various forms of foreign interference in terms of who's funding, who's providing databases and so forth. Various allegations have been made, but we do need to do a lot more research and we need a lot more transparency about what's going on. We also need to find ways of holding up a mirror to this new kind of campaigning, because one of the problems with targeted advertising is that the ads that you receive and the campaign messages, which are mainly just images with simple slogans, disappear after you see them. So that means that voters can't then return to that material, and they can't work out if the message that they've received is very different to messages perhaps in other constituencies received. So it's important that we try and monitor a little bit what kind of messaging is going out there in order to get more transparency and hold the politicians who are deploying this kind of material to account.
Damian Tambini from the London School of Economics there. Polly, you've seen this from all sides as a voter, a spin doctor and a politician. Are politicians only now getting to grips with the power of online messaging? And is it open to abuse, do you think?
I don't think they have got to grips with it. I think it's partly because it changes so quickly. I'd be really interested to hear what Alex thinks about it. I mean, I know that as a politician in, you know, comfortable middle age, what I always need to do is to raise enough money to hire somebody to do my stuff for me, because I know I will definitely get it wrong. And that isn't about necessarily targeting young people. It's simply knowing and understanding how the technology works, and that I might be a good communicator in terms of developing messaging and strategy and so forth, but I will definitely make the wrong call because it's not my skill set. And of course, politicians are very reluctant to do that because the tendency is to think that you need to know everything. And delegating is a great strength of a leader. And I would just say raise the money, employ somebody, and make sure that you can trust them to make sure that you don't look like a fool.
And Raph, we know lots of money's flowing into it. We certainly know that money was spent on it in the Vote Leave campaign and in the 2015 general election, and money that might once have gone on billboards or newspaper pages. Sigh. Isn't it perverse that the Conservative Party say can flood Facebook with ads, not Sky TV?
Yes, I think the whole mechanism and the regulatory framework is set up for an analogue world, and it means that you know, just in terms of your limitations to what you can broadcast, don't really make much sense when people are getting their video content on Facebook. Likewise, it's worth pointing out in this respect that the scandal was never quite as much of a scandal as some people seem to want it to be about election expenses and what was spent at constituency level, which should have been booked as national campaign money or vice versa, actually. Also looks a little bit obsolete when your targeted Facebook ad can, you know, is based on postcode. Obviously, you're getting to at people in particular seats because those are the seats you want to win. Now, is that constituency spend? Is that national spend? It's actually street by street, house by house spend. So you might get a Facebook ad telling you that politician X can't be trusted to rescue circus animals because you care about that. But next door, they're getting one saying, you know, politician Y can't be trusted to kind of put the bins out because that's what they care about most. And so that does feel like the whole system is, as I say, it's all a bit analog in terms of how we control, regulate, oversee this stuff.
What we're finding really fascinating right now, though, is how much of a black box this all is. It's very easy to tell these stories of a conservative advert targeted at plumbers on Facebook because they know the plumbers. Finding these things is impossible. If you are a plumber listening who gets a targeted advert that clearly seems to be targeted to you as a plumber, please send it to us because we can't find any of this. And it's semi-deliberate. You know, obviously, the adverts targeted to plumbers are not going to be sent to Guardian journalists. But it's also, it's the nature of Facebook's black box advertising is it doesn't want to leak this information. Even if you, and I'm obviously the sort of person who does, click on why am I shown this advert? And Facebook will tell you, you are shown this advert based on a few demographic indicators, your age, where you live, your gender. It doesn't tell you everything else. There's this huge array of targeting demographic and interest and behavioral categories that Facebook can put you in, which advertisers can use and which even you at the receiving end of the advert have no way of knowing whether or not it has been used. All of which is to say that it's easy to let the imagination run riot. It's also easy to dismiss until and unless we get someone inside one of the campaigns talking about how they spend their money. All we can really say for certain is that Facebook is extraordinarily powerful and that when we talk about social media, really, we talk about Facebook. Twitter is useful for driving conversation amongst the elites.
Yeah, but it's not a vote switcher at all.
It's not a vote switcher. It's a conversation changer, maybe, but that's press, media and other politicians. Facebook is the only game in town and it's an utter black box. Yesterday, I was up in Oxford speaking to the Oxford Internet Institute, who have been running a 3-year research study now on automated messaging on Twitter. They're studying Twitter because they cannot study Facebook. They're fairly explicit about this. They would like to study Facebook, but Facebook is so locked down, so closed off, so opaque that instead they have to turn to the social media channel, which at least they can take a look at. Even there, they can only see 1% of the posts. Twitter blocks their access off to 99% and gives them what they assume is a random 1%. But their best bet is that Twitter automation is vaguely analogous to Facebook automation, that someone who spends a lot of money making automated Twitter accounts is probably spending roughly the same money on Facebook, and that this stuff matters. But it's so hard to find out, and that's scary.
There's still a lot to think about there, and we will be able to see afterwards, won't we, how much the parties have spent.
How much they've spent.
On different kinds of advertising, but as you say, how effective it was and how it was targeted and so on.
Even then, typically the way it happens is we get to see that the parties spent money on a social media advertising partner, and that partner doesn't have to reveal their breakdown of the spending. Even simply knowing whether it went on Facebook or Twitter is something we probably won't find out, let alone Instagram and Pinterest.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think we shouldn't round off without just asking Polly, what did you think about... So poor old Ed Miliband never looked terribly happy when he had to wheel his wife out on stage. did you watch Theresa May and Philip May cuddled up on the sofa on the One Show this week? And what did you think?
I didn't watch it live. I did watch it back, as you say, on social media because obviously people had clipped it. And I was most... outraged, I'm afraid to say, by the girl jobs and the boy jobs. And I'm sure Philip May thought he was saying something really radical.
This is him saying he puts the bins out.
He puts the bins out, she runs the country, as though that's sort of really radical. But, you know, I've got three nieces. If they don't know that every job in the house needs to be done by everybody and that we are all capable of running the country, building an aeroplane, transforming our world in order to be able to tackle climate change, and they think that all they're supposed to be doing is getting their dad to put the bins out, I would be really worried. And I thought that sort of told you quite a lot, and was quite, which just made me feel a bit depressed, really.
And is it a mistake for spouses to be wheeled out at all?
No, I was talking about this last night. I think what we need to understand is that most people are not very political, and what they want to do is they want to know and understand you and connect with you as a person. And it is therefore entirely reasonable for them to want to connect with you on the terms in which they define themselves. And what are the most important things for most people? It's the people that they love, their own good health, the place that they live, and the work that they do. Probably in that order.
Right? So it kind of puts them in a context that people can relate to.
It puts you in a context. So, you know, that it is not unreasonable. And if we spend our time being sort of hard-faced super rationalists, how dare you ask me about who I happen to sleep with, then actually, or who I care about more broadly, and who puts my bins out, then what you're doing is you're cutting yourself off from the opportunity to connect with people. And politics should be about connecting with people, because unless you can connect across the things that might divide you, you don't have the opportunity to be able to persuade and to build a coalition that you need in order to be able to do the things you want to do.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Alex Hearn, Polly Billington and Raphael Baer. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.